Today, NPR begins a new series about email, which too often is becoming a burden rather than a blessing. Many of us have friends or family members who love to forward messages, hoaxes, urban myths, political calls to action. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has this story on the junk mail that comes from your kin.
Deborah Burton has an ongoing disagreement with her 75-year-old father, Clyde Burton. He sends her lots of email.
The ones that I cannot stand are the chain emails. If you don't forward this to 10 people within 5 to 10 minutes, doom and gloom, and, you know, you will have no financial luck, etc. So I have asked him to please never send me any chain email letters. But it still does.
Chain emails? But sometimes, you know, they're maybe entertaining occasionally. I may have sent her something like that.
You could say Clyde Burton has a lifelong affinity for mailing things. He was a postmaster in Gloucester County, Virginia for 37 years. He retired and discovered email. He now spends hours exploring the web, where he finds things and sends them along. These include music, pictures, and warnings about computer viruses. The list of recipients, besides his only daughter, is long. He sends them to his best friend who lives an hour away, a brother-in-law who doesn't share his political views, general acquaintances, and neighbors. For a man whose career involved postage and mail carriers, email is like magic.
It's so easy. Double-click your address book and send now, and it's gone.
But what do you do if you're on the receiving end, or if the emails are totally false or make you mad? There's a site that collects hoax letters and urban myths that circulate on the internet. Snopes.com evaluates the truth of the claims. There's a popular email about Democratic presidential hopeful Barack Obama. It claims he doesn't cover his heart during the Pledge of Allegiance, but that's not true. There's another one about robbers using ether-laced perfume to stun victims in parking lots. The site says that's also not true. But aside from basic truth squatting, there's a sticky issue of having to say, I love you, Grandma, but the emails you send are annoying.
Well, it makes it more difficult because it is family, so we are more apt to be more courteous.
That's Diane Gotsman, founder of the Protocol School of Texas. She fields lots of etiquette questions about email, in particular ones from parents directing their children to back a political candidate. Her advice is to call and ask to be taken off their list. And if that doesn't work, she says it's okay to go nuclear.
Filter them out. Block them.
Fighting email with email is futile, she says. It reinforces bad behavior. Email escalated a political fight in Maura Corbett's large family. The exchanges got nasty and caused a huge rift.
When you see them in person at, like, the next family party, there's this weird awkwardness because everybody's kind of gone after everybody else on the email list. But now you're in front of everybody and you're supposed to be nice at, like, a holiday party or whatever. And so nobody acknowledges it.
Now, with a new election season, she said the family email is again in full swing.
You know, I'm often horrified. People I've known my whole life and have grown up have such radically different views. And in the era of instantaneous information, they can constantly remind me of that.
At least for Clyde Burton, he says often his intention isn't so much to warn of viruses or bother his daughter with chain emails. It's just an excuse to reach out.
I'm probably not a person that would say to Deborah, I love you very frequently. And that's not a good trait. I understand that. But I can tell her that in an email. Why is that?
Why is that indeed? Whatever it is, email seems to liberate us to speak our mind to the benefit and the detriment of our families. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, how the increasing volume of email actually makes us less productive. The sounds of Scotland come honestly to David Russell. So do the sounds of Spain. His parents were Scottish, artists, bohemians. When Russell was a kid, they moved to Spain, a village on the island of Menorca. Back then, the family traveled around in a camper van. These days, the town isn't much bigger, about 1,200 people. There is, though, an avenue named for its best-known classical guitarist. They call it Avinguda David Russell. Russell's way with a guitar has also got his name on marquees around the world and on a 2005 Grammy Award. That was for his CD, Aire Latino. His latest recorded offering is called Air on a G-String. It's a collection of music from the time of Johann Sebastian Bach. And David Russell is in the studio with his guitar. What a pleasure to meet you.
Hello. It's nice to be here.
How did they name? Why did they name a street after you?
Well, they named me, first of all, adopted son. And usually you have to be dead before that happens. But so the last street that they opened, they gave it my name.
Were you introduced to the art of Spanish classical guitar when you were there? Because, you know, after all, I mean, Andre Segovia, he was the classical guitar player, right?
Segovia did some really special things. With two notes, he could give you the chills. So I spent hours trying to imitate some of his phrases on it, yes.
Was there one tune in particular that was, you know, meant something to you?
Oh, yeah, there were lots. But there's a very famous tune called Recuerdos de la Alhambra by Tárrega. It's a bit that goes... So that top note, he would play just so quietly, so you get the... You know, I sometimes do it a little bit, but I feel that it's getting a little bit close to kind of imitating the master, shall we say.
Yeah.
But some of that in certain pieces of music are really beautiful. But when you do it in a piece of Bach, it doesn't work. You know,
yeah,
you need to be straighter.
Because Bach's music is almost more mathematical in many ways.
Sort of, yes. I'm sure Bach felt it was very emotional as well. But
sure.
It does have a higher level, so you really have to give the whole phrase without stopping on a note just because you like it.
Do you have to sometimes resist the, I don't know, the temptation to get yourself lost in listening to the music and all of a sudden your fingers have run up the road?
Well, I get to do that at home. So when I'm in public, I've got to be on the ball because, you know, I'm hoping that that's happening to my audience, not to me.
I have to bring up Bach's Air on a G String. There is not a bride or groom, I think, that are not familiar with this piece of music. Sound fresh?
Well, I once played some concerts with a jazz guitarist, Barney Kessel. And Barney did the introductions. He was very, very eloquent. So he said, we jazz guys, we take a tune and we add all these other notes and things and play it completely differently. And the classical guys, they take the tune, they play the same notes and they work really hard to make it sound completely fresh every night.
Even in Bach's time, there was a premium on the ability to improvise and embellish and make things fresh. And I don't know, maybe when you have a perfect melody, you don't actually want to do this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you do have to make it your own. I have to play, though, some pieces where you have taken, it sounds like you've taken, a few more liberties. Let's hear this one by Jacques de Saint-Luc. What is that, and how much of what we're hearing is 300 years old, and how much is 2008 David Rosen?
A lot of it is my improvisation. I'm not a great improviser in the Baroque style, but all the ornamentation is mine. The thing is, if you have a piece by Bach, he often develops the piece to such a high level that you can hardly do much more to it. But Jacques de Saint-Luc wrote very simple Baroque music, and so if you don't embellish it, it just falls apart. It sounds way too simple.
By comparison, I guess, let's just play this from your Grammy-winning CD. This is Danza Brasileira by Jorge Morel. That is so different,
yes.
And it just seems like you go from speaking one language to another.
Yeah, it's really strange to hear them kind of like one straight after
yeah,
the
yeah.
other. Obviously, whoa, it doesn't sound anything like. But, you know, if I'm playing the Baroque music, it's usually a brighter sound, a cleaner sound, you would say, and that's got a slightly huskier sound in it, you know, which I do with the hands, you know. If I play straighter to the string, you get more of this kind of sound.
Bright.
Yeah, bright. And if I turn sideways, it gets more velvety.
I think we've held people off long enough because you do have your guitar here, a beautiful guitar, and you're going to take us out with a tune. Why don't you tell us what you're going to play?
A piece by Agustín Barrios, Una Limosna por el Amor de Dios, which means alms for the love of God. And supposedly, he was in El Salvador as an old man, and this beggar woman would come and slowly knock on his door gently, and that's actually, you hear at the beginning of the piece, you hear the slow notes, and then she would sing a song asking for something.
Classical guitarist David Russell. His new CD is called Air on a G-String. It features music from the world of Bach. This is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed by Robert Wharton's son, Ned, with production help from Chip Kranz's daughter, Laura, Erwin Waters' daughter, Gemma, Kevin Malone's son, Eamon, Carlos Valdivieso's daughter, Katerina, Stuart Gold's daughter, Jenny, Chris George's daughter, Susanna, and Stephen Tapscott's daughter, Rebecca. We had help from our librarians, Joe Shields' daughter, Kimaleski, and Peter Glendenning's daughter, Mary. Our technical director is Mike Hun's son, Burke, and our engineer is John Maynor's son, Kevin. Our senior editor is Bill Miller's daughter, Jenny Bergall. Our senior producer is Nader Ardalan's daughter, Davar Iran. I'm Edwin Hansen's daughter, Leanne. Once upon a time, every Broadway musical had an overture. Now, because of changes in both taste and economics, it is a rare occurrence. But this season, two musical revivals, which are up for several Tony Awards tonight, South Pacific and Gypsy, feature overtures played by large orchestras in full view of the audience. Jeff London has this appreciation of the Broadway overture.
For years now, the Broadway orchestra has been shrinking in size, and most shows these days skip the overture entirely. And when a musical actually has an overture, it seems like, well, an afterthought. Of the four shows nominated for the Best Musical Tony this year, only one, Crybaby, has an overture. Sort of.
Take your seat!
The Broadway overture has traditionally set the tone for the evening to follow. It's kind of a bridge for the audience between real life and the theatrical world they're about to enter.
Cell phones off!
In the case of Crybaby, it's a satirical world that thumbs its nose at convention. In the case of Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific, it's a grand canvas of World War II-era romanticism and drama.
One of the things when we talk about the golden era and how wonderful everything was has a lot to do with the fact that, well, they spent a little bit more money and gave a little bit more attention to the music.
Bruce Pomahack is director of music for the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization.
The music just wasn't something to be dealt with on the side the way it seems to be today. Just put the orchestra upstairs, put it in the basement, just get it out of the way. We'll just mic it into the theater. And five pieces, six pieces. No, they had what they needed to make the score happen. Rodgers needed 40 to make Carousel happen, and he got it. He needed 30 to make South Pacific happen.
Broadway overtures, though, were rarely written by a show's composer. They were stitched together by the orchestrators, who took the composer's scores and created arrangements for a full orchestra in the pit, sometimes artfully, sometimes not so artfully. Bruce Pomahack says Richard Rodgers worked with one of the best.
Robert Russell Bennett handled this chore for Rodgers, but Rodgers could trust him because Bennett was very organic about it.
Indeed, Bennett is receiving a special posthumous Tony Award this evening in recognition of his contributions to creating the Broadway sound. Ted Sperling, conductor of the revival of South Pacific, has been entrusted with recreating that sound. He says the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization gave him and his 30-piece orchestra the opportunity to look at the original parts from the 1949 Broadway pit. They used several of the markings and phrasings those musicians scribbled in their books 59 years ago.
And I encouraged a rather old-fashioned style of playing from the whole orchestra. I asked everybody to pretend that we lived in an age where being expressive and wearing your heart on your sleeve is not something to be embarrassed about. You know, that we could just go for the bigger gesture with more vibrato, more schmaltz, if you will.
When the South Pacific Overture ends, the entire orchestra, in tuxedos and formal wear, stands up and takes a bow from the pit of the Vivian Beaumont Theater. 11 blocks downtown, at the St. James Theater, the 25 musicians in the revival of Gypsy are actually on stage. Sid Raymond created the Gypsy Overture with Red Ginsler from Julie Stein's tunes way back in 1959. Raymond says when he went to see the revival, the overture had the audience from hello.
I was thrilled when I went to opening just a few weeks ago, and when the audience heard those first four notes, they immediately began to applaud, and it was like those four notes were the four magic notes.
Patrick Vaccariello is music director for the revival. He says putting the orchestra on stage changes the audience dynamic.
They actually listen. Normally the audience in the overture, if they're in the pit, they're talking. Here I really sense that they are in their seats, opening up their ears and hearing music. And it's a beautiful thing. There's nothing like watching live musicians play. You know, you have the real strings. There aren't any synthesizers, the real harp. Just an old-fashioned piano, and you sense that the audience really, really appreciates the sound.
Gypsy is based on the memoirs of Gypsy Rose Lee, the striptease queen of America, and there is a raunchy, down-and-dirty trumpet solo towards the end of the overture. In other productions, nobody can see the trumpet player. Here, Tony Cadleck, horn in hand, stands up to play the solo.
It's nerve-wracking to stand up. I mean, we've been anonymous so long, and you know, to some degree, we're still anonymous, but to stand up and have the spotlight, I mean, it's kind of cool. It's a little bit of a rush, and I still get goosebumps, and, you know, occasionally, or most often, they applaud.
Both Gypsy and South Pacific are nominated for Tony Awards for Best Musical Revival tonight. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And to find out more about the Tony Awards, hear music and see pictures from the nominated shows, and read theater reporter Jeff London's predictions, go to npr.org.
Yeah. If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a fur coat, but not a real fur coat, that's cruel.
This is a song by the Canadian band Bare Naked Ladies. If you even walked past a radio in the 90s, you probably heard it. Over the years, the band's biggest hits have all been quirky, bouncy, playful. It's no surprise, then, that their new record, their first written for children, is one big party. So on this Father's Day, let's get a taste of their new album. It's called Snack Time.
A is for aisle, B is for Delium, C is for Czar, and if you see him, would you mind telling him?
Okay, hang on a second. You got aisle,
yeah,
Delium.
Aisle, like a theater.
Right, okay, and then Delium?
Delium, it's a gum-like tree resin. It starts with a silent B.
And then Czar.
Yeah, it's like a Russian Czar. You know, everybody knows apple, ball, and cat. I wanted to get into some stranger words.
Right, I see what you're doing.
Two members of Bare Naked Ladies join me now from NPR Studio in Culver City, California. We have Stephen Page and Kevin Hearn. Welcome to the show.
How are you?
Hi.
The song we're listening to now, called Crazy ABCs, and Stephen Page, I understand you co-wrote this one. And let me just point out, P is for pneumonia, pterodactyl, and psychosis.
That's right, because we figured enough, if you're going to actually stoop so low as to put another alphabet song on the record, you may as well mess with it as best you can. And, you know, one of the things that we do, and we've always done in the band, this is our 20th anniversary, and, you know, when Ed and I started the group, a lot of what we did was that banter, and that banter you hear in Crazy ABCs is the same kind of thing we do in If I Had $1 Million and often do in the shows.
That's Ed Robertson, who sings and plays guitars with you guys.
Yeah. And who forgot to put a word for the letter I in the song, which we didn't realize till after we'd recorded it.
He went back and stuck it in, rewrote some of the lyrics to stick it in, and then realized he put it in the wrong order. So now it goes A, B, C, D, E, F, G, I, H, J, K, L, N, O, P.
Yeah, it goes G is for gnarly,
yeah.
I is for irk,
yeah.
And H is for hour.
Yeah.
That's crazy ABCs.
That's stupid ABCs.
But is it important to you to make music that won't drive parents crazy too?
Absolutely. We wanted to make a record that parents would enjoy listening to and wouldn't get tired of.
You know, I have lots of memories of being in my car on long road trips with I have three boys, and listening to the same songs over and over again, mm-hmm. and being thankful for the ones that I loved, and really when it came to listening to the Crazy Frog album, I wanted to tear my hair out.
Is that the Wiggles?
No, the Crazy Frog was this British phenomenon. It started as, I think it was actually Swedish, it started as a ringtone. There were like all kinds of little web videos and so on for it. It became kind of a phenomenon in Europe, and I guess it crossed over here a little bit a couple years ago, and it's really awful stuff, but fun.
Well, I tell you, my daughter now says, Mommy, I want popcorn song. I want popcorn song.
Yay.
So let's play her the popcorn song.
Mama put the popcorn kernels in the pot. She turned up the heat, now the pot is getting hot. And then those popcorn kernels start to pop, pop.
Sounds like popcorn popping.
It is.
And I mean,
that's my childhood choir joining us singing on that one.
It's actually the same kids that you sang with as a child.
Yeah, they didn't grow up.
And of course, it's part of a trilogy of pieces on this album, the Canadian Snack Time Trilogy. You know, we have popcorn too here in America.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't realize that it was originated in Canada during the Canadian invasion of 1964, where the great Canadian group The Beatles came down to the United States. A lot of people don't realize that they snuck in with them their mentor, scientist Orville Redenbacher, who hails from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
Popcorn!
There's a reference to The Beatles in one of your songs, in the allergies. The part where they go, ah, chew.
Right.
But there's another reference to something, and I can't quite put my finger on it. Like, can we just play the beginning of track 12?
No.
Please?
Okay.
Oh, please.
There's a blueberry pancake flying in the sky. I can see it. I can see it. And there's a castle in the cloud and it's floating on by. Can you see it? Can you see it?
Okay, stop. Okay, stop. That's all I needed. Now, okay, between several people we came up with, The Heat Is On.
Yes, you got it. Okay.
By Glenn Frey. Oh, okay. That was the right one. Okay.
You had to have seen us in the studio. Like, what song is this? What is this? It's whatever it is, it's staying. And we're thinking, is it Neutron Dance? And we realize, no, it's Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack, though. It was Heat Is On.
So you guys knew, you actually knew the riff and then went back to try and figure out what it was. So was it intentional to sprinkle in these sort of musical references to adult music?
Each song sort of became its own little journey, and that one sort of took a turn into the 80s.
The thing is for us is that we love all those kind of pop culture references, and we know that kids aren't always going to get it, but you can't play down to kids all the time. You want them to hear you having fun. And making a kid's record, I think we were a lot less self-conscious about those kinds of choices than we would be on a regular record, you know, about the kinds of references we'd make or the limits to pastiche.
So we've talked a lot here about why these are good kids' songs. What makes a really bad kids' song, like a horrible one?
I think things that try really hard to teach moral lessons to children, those kind of finger-wagging or condescending songs that treat kids as stupid. And a lot of that is just in the performance, too, that kind of, hey, kids, how are you? Eat your vegetables and brush your teeth 3 times a day. Let's get some exercise. That stuff makes me crazy. When I look at records that I grew up with that have moral messages, things like Free to Be You and Me or The Point or, you know, a lot of the Sesame Street material. Think about Schoolhouse Rock, which is all purpose-built music. But it has a lightness and a sense of humor and a sense of heart to it that's not just about, teaching somebody something.
You've been touring with this CD, and how have kids responded?
They throw things at us.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it's been really great.
Stephen Page and Kevin Hearn are two members of the band Bare Naked Ladies. They've just released their first CD for kids. It's called Snack Time. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
There's more from the album at npr.org. Look for the music section. And one final Father's Day treat, my favorite song on the album, Pollywog in a Bog.
In a puddle by the trail, flips its tiny tail, just like a great big whale, but smaller than a snail. It's a pollywog in a bog, swims under soggy logs. One day you'll be a frog, pollywog in a bog.
Parting words tonight from scholar and author Greta Hoffman Nemiroff. She wrote, "Children bring us a sense of intimacy which cannot be replicated in adult relationships. Being attentive to physical comfort, hurt feelings, the ability to play with total concentration and joy, the nakedness of childhood preoccupations helps us to keep in touch with ourselves, with the child imprisoned within each adult."
Ribbit, ribbit, a tadpole exhibit, it's a transformation. No one can inhibit amphibian change. May seem strange, take them gills and the tail and they all rearrange.
And that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Have a great week. Still a few hours left in Father's Day, which gives us a chance to celebrate Dad as part of our series, You Must Read This. Jen Lancaster wrote the 2006 book Bitter is the New Black, and she's the creator of the blog jensylvania.com. She remembers how one writer helped her and her dad share some laughs 25 years ago.
I was upstairs when I first heard the noise. Home alone on a Friday night, due to a geometry-related offense, I reacted like every other teenage slasher film victim, running directly toward the source. I flew down the stairs and through the breakfast nook, only to come face to face with the scariest person of all. Not Freddy Krueger or Michael Myers, but Ronald Lancaster, my father. Back in early 1983, his job stress was overwhelming and his good humor was practically non-existent. Yet when I clattered down the steps, there was my dad, and he seemed happy. I was as surprised to see him smiling as I was to see him home, so I decided to endure whatever boring British farce he had on and joined him in the family room. My father was watching a movie called The Star-Crossed Romance of Josephine Kosnowski. Turns out the noise I'd heard was laughter because the show was dramatic but hilarious. My father and I spent the next hour cackling so loud our dog hid under the kitchen table. When it was over, my father told me Gene Shepherd had written what we'd watched. He told me if I looked in his bookshelf, I'd find the Josephine Kosnowski story and many others in Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and other disasters. I grabbed the book and headed back upstairs where I immersed myself in Shepherd's distinctive voice. I snorted over stories of bad country neighbors and their rogue ham-stealing dogs in the grandstand passion play of Delbert and the Bumpus Hounds, later to be immortalized as turkey-stealing bloodhounds in the film A Christmas Story. My stomach ached as Shepherd recounted his heroic intake of junk food in County Fair. His description of being jammed into a 15-inch space of back seat, carved out of picnic baskets and inner tubes, hit a little too close to home in Ollie Hopnoodle's Haven of Bliss. Yet that story made me nostalgic for my own miserable family road trips, and I recalled having contests with my brother over who could eat and drink the least because my dad considered rest stops a luxury. I finished Wanda Hickey in a few hours. Later, over blueberry pancakes, Dad and I laughed about our favorite scenes. When I was 15, I didn't fully appreciate Shepherd's ability to turn simple childhood injustices into Greek tragedies. I had no idea that one day Jerry Seinfeld would credit Shepherd for forming his entire comedic sensibility. I didn't know that later that year, Shepherd's movie A Christmas Story would become a tradition for millions of American families. All I knew was that he wrote a book that helped my dad and me find some common ground, enjoying the kind of relaxed banter we hadn't had since my childhood.
Jen Lancaster is a best-selling author and blogger. She lives in Chicago. For more You Must Read This recommendations, go to npr.org.
Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama visited Quincy, Illinois yesterday, viewing the flooding along the Mississippi River and helping load sandbags. His Republican opponent, John McCain, hosted a virtual town meeting where he was joined by Carly Fiorina, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, in an effort to beef up support from women voters. There's not much on either man's public schedule today. It's Father's Day, after all. So we decided we wanted to hear about the fathers of both presidential candidates. Admiral John McCain Jr. and Barack Obama Sr. passed away decades ago. Each man not only gave his own name to his son, but gave him the drive to become the next president. NPR's Robert Smith explains.
When John McCain and Barack Obama talk about their fathers, you can hear that they're finishing a journey that someone else began.
I'm the son and grandson of admirals.
I'm the son of a black man.
My grandfather was an aviator, my father a submariner.
My grandfather was a cook to the British. In Kenya, grew up in a small village. And all his life, that's all he was a cook and a houseboy. And that's what
they were my first heroes.
And his son, who grew up herding goats in a small village in Africa, could suddenly set his sights a little higher and suddenly believe that maybe a black man in this world had a chance.
Two versions of the American dream, as different as can be. But when Obama and McCain tell the stories of their families, you can hear the same theme, a distant father they long to know more about. Obama wrote a whole book about the quest, Dreams from My Father, where he talks about the man who abandoned him.
My father remained a myth to me, both more and less than a man. He had left Hawaii back in 1963 when I was just two,
so that as a child I knew him only through the stories that my mother and grandparents told.
In those stories, the senior Barack Obama was brilliant, engaging, passionate. So much so that the young Obama began to embellish the legend, like this story he made up for his classmates.
My grandfather, see, he's a chief, so that makes my father a prince. The men in our tribe all want to be chief, so my father has to settle these feuds before I can come.
John McCain's father must have seemed no less regal and almost as distant to his son. McCain's dad was a submarine commander, and after Pearl Harbor, he was gone for most of World War II. John McCain was 5 years old at the time.
The relationship of a sailor and his children is, in large part, a metaphysical one. We see much less of our fathers than do other children. You're taught to consider their absence not as a deprivation, but as an honor.
McCain also wrote a book about his family called Faith of My Fathers. And like Obama's book, it includes a lot of facts about his dad, but almost nothing about the relationship. McCain and his father didn't play sports together. They didn't participate in any hobbies. If they shared anything, it was a reputation for blunt opinions and getting into trouble.
My father returned from war with a great appetite for drink, which he overindulged until the very last years of his life. He was never completely incapacitated by his weakness. But when he was drunk, I did not recognize him.
In neither book do you hear a lot of affection when they talk about their fathers. Instead, there was admiration and respect. Both Barack Obama and John McCain went to their father's schools, Obama to Harvard, and McCain to the Naval Academy. Then the two stories diverge. Obama's father died young, 46 years old, in a car crash in Kenya. When Obama finally went to visit his relatives in Africa, he found out the truth.
All my life, I had carried a single image of my father. The brilliant scholar, the generous friend, the upstanding leader. Now, that image had suddenly vanished. Replaced by what? A bitter drunk? A defeated, lonely bureaucrat? To think that all my life I had been wrestling with nothing more than a ghost. Whatever I do, it seems, I won't do much worse than he did.
Obama may have been set free, but McCain, at a similar point in his life, couldn't let go. McCain's father became a four-star admiral, commander of the Pacific Forces during the Vietnam War. John McCain served under him and was a prisoner of war in Hanoi.
Late in the war, my father would give the order that sent B-52s to rain destruction upon the city where I was held a prisoner. That was his duty, and he did not shrink from it. While I was in prison, he never spoke about me at length to anyone other than my wife and mother.
McCain talks in excruciating detail in his book about being tortured and the shame he felt when he gave in. McCain dreaded that his father would hear his taped confession. But after he was released, McCain says they didn't talk about it much.
On the one occasion when I briefly recounted the experience for him, he listened impassively until I finished, put his hand on my shoulder and said, "You did the best you could, John. That's all that's expected of any of us."
It was more praise than Barack Obama ever got directly from his father. After the elder Obama left, he met with his son just once. Obama only found out later that his father would brag about him and read his son's letters over and over again. The two fathers, John McCain and Barack Obama, died in the early 1980s. Neither man would see his son elected to public office. Robert Smith, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.